Ishmael takes out an ad for people who are looking to save the world. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the difficulty of spreading new ideas to people who are not ready to save the world, or people who don't think the world is in deep trouble, or talk about the possibility of that.
Yeah, people write to me all the time saying, how do I interest my friends in your work? They seem indifferent. They don't care about the fate of the world, or they're not worried. I tell them that there are plenty of people who are ready for it and who will listen. Not to worry about the ones who are not ready to listen yet.
People who present visions for change often divide the world into two different types of people. For example, the communists talk about the bourgeois and the proletariat. In your books, you talk about leavers, or tribal people, and takers, the people of civilization. And I was wondering, I know it would make more sense in the context of a book, but I was wondering if you could briefly talk to us a little bit about the difference between takers and leavers.
It's hard to do briefly. The way history is taught in our schools, humanity lived for 3 to 5 million years as hunter-gatherers, and then about 10,000 years ago discovered agriculture and then began to build civilization. Of course, this is untrue, as any historian knows, but this is the way it's taught. This did not happen. Humanity did not 10,000 years ago take a new direction. What did happen was the people of one culture took a new direction and became full-time agriculturalists. And as their numbers grew, they overran people. The rest of the world went on living the way that they had always lived up until the present moment, as a matter of fact. This movement of ours, of our culture, reached the Americas, of course, at the end of the 15th century. Rather than talk about Aboriginal peoples or primitive peoples, I chose to call them leavers and takers, leavers being those who left the running of the world to the gods, the takers being those who took the rule of the world into their own hands. Anywhere in the world you go, if the food is under lock and key, then you know you are among takers. If it is not, then you are among leavers, because it was we who put the food under lock and key, and that's the basis of all of our economy and our wealth. Things that takers have in common are that we believe that the world was made for man and man was made to conquer and rule it, and that there is one right way for people to live, and that we have it, and that everyone in the world should be made to live the way we live. Globalization is something that we invented many thousands of years ago.
In addition to locking up food and thinking that there's one way for humans to live, it seems that the other thing that you focus on a lot in taker culture is hierarchies. Could you maybe contrast a little bit the difference of what a hierarchy might mean in taker culture, which I guess we're all familiar with what hierarchies might mean in leaver culture?
The difference is that among tribal peoples, there is very little that is hierarchical. They aren't ruled as we are ruled. There is no rich class, middle class, and suffering class at the bottom. It is notably an egalitarian form of life.
How did you do studies of Aboriginal peoples? Have you traveled a lot, or do you read mostly? How do you get information about how Aboriginal peoples live?
Well, there's tons of it. I did spend 20 years reading before I ever even thought of writing a book. I wasn't doing research. I was simply trying to answer questions, my own questions.
And also, in terms of gorillas, how did you how much have you studied gorillas?
Not at all.
What do you think we're in for ecologically if we continue in taker culture? How long until what happens?
What we're doing right now is converting the planet's biomass into human mass. Right now, it's estimated that 200 species a day are becoming extinct because of our needs are driving them into extinction as we burn down forests, convert land to cropland. And this is an attack on the biodiversity of the living community. We depend completely on that living community and always will. We are in a period of mass extinctions. Now that's well acknowledged. We're like people living at the top of a tall building. Every day we go down to the lower floors and knock out 200 bricks from the walls and take them back upstairs to improve our own space. This can go on for quite a while because there are a lot of bricks in a big building. But eventually there's going to develop a fault, and the building is going to come down very rapidly. And that's going to happen to us if we continue to live this way. It's very doubtful that 6 billion people is a sustainable human population. But as for how long we can go on like this, that I wouldn't try to predict.
I read a criticism that you wrote of file sharing online because writers and artists need to make money. As an artist myself who makes a fair amount of work for free on the internet, I've seen behaviors that seem less like the process that you describe in taker communities of trading goods for goods and more like what you describe as a lever trait, giving support in exchange for getting support. Similarly, if you go to a mass mobilization, there will inevitably be a group like Food Not Bombs giving out free food. And our interview is, in fact, part of a global project of exchanging support, services, and copyright-free work called Indie Media. People just seem to volunteer to do things to help out those who are giving out their free time, energy, art, and music. I was wondering if I might influence you to rethink file sharing and copyright-free artists in accord with your own ideals as expressed in My Ishmael.
Any artist who wants to make his or her work available for free certainly should do so. But I, for one, would not have been able to write the books that I've written under those circumstances. I'd be homeless. And I do think that eventually, if all music were free, then the music industry would disappear.
Right on. Sounds all right to me. I found a very warm global community that rewards volunteer and copyright-free efforts and often manage to trade a CD for a meal or whatever. You say that in reading Malcolm X, you saw that he had associated the white race with Satan, and this was actually an inspiration for writing Ishmael. Can you explain how this worked?
Yes. When I read that, I said the white race is something else. And examining the story in Genesis, the conflict between Cain and Abel, I came up with a theory that Abel was actually the name given to themselves by a Semitic people who lived south of the people of the Garden of Eden, that area, Fertile Crescent, which was inhabited by Caucasians, as a matter of fact. And just as when we arrived on this continent and immediately began to attack the native peoples and to take their land, this was what was happening. What was being described there is that Cain was watering his fields with the blood of Abel. That's what it says in the Bible. And so that I developed a theory that what the text had in mind was Cain had a mark which identified him and thought it not completely impossible that the mark was his color. And so that if the white race is anything, the white race is not Satan, but Cain.
In the history of interactions between tribal people and civilized people, the levers have been disadvantaged militarily. How do you see levers currently, or in the future, being able to stand up to the military powers of the remaining portions of taker culture, even if those numbers of takers begin to decline?
Oh, well, they can't. In an armed confrontation, the takers will always win. They have unlimited resources.
So then what you hope for is that the takers stop fighting?
Well, they're not fighting so much as growing. We need, or we imagine we need, the resources that are presently being underused from our point of view by native peoples. That was what our argument here in North America was. You are underusing all these wonderful resources, and God wants us to take them away from you and put them to good use.
Talk a little bit about the differences between laws in taker culture and lever systems of dealing with problematic behaviors.
Yes, our laws, of course, are prohibitions, you know, from very ancient times. Tribal law is not a set of prohibitions. Rather, tribal law provides principles and customs for dealing with bad behavior, dealing with the effects of bad behavior, with the object of restoring order and restoring health to the society of the tribe. So the question is not how shall we punish this wrongdoer, but rather how can we make him stop, for one thing. But if the wrong has already been done, how do we mend it? And that this law is different from one tribe to another. When, at the beginning of our culture, we brought many, many tribes under the umbrella of the new agricultural revolution, the totalitarian agricultural revolution, tribal law no longer made any sense. Because whose law were we going to follow? This tribe, or this tribe, or this tribe, or this tribe. So it became incumbent upon people of our culture to invent laws, and they took the form of prohibitions. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, and so on. Because those other laws were all gone. They knew how to handle all these things in a way that satisfied everybody. Whereas now we see horrible situations perpetrated because rather than trying to do what's best for everyone involved, now we just apply the law. So that a few years ago, the case of a school teacher who had a love affair with a student and
a 14-year-old.
Yeah, 14-year-old. And parents were not upset about her having an affair. The student was not upset. the law came along and put her in jail. And exactly who did that benefit?
I think that's the message of Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. I want you to talk for a minute just about propaganda. Your books are very straightforward, and in an Orwellian era when politicians are calling war peace and poverty wealth, and so many meaningful messages have been turned against themselves in the service of the existing power structure, how do you attack propaganda?
Every culture has a mother culture who is the great educator and who speaks to the members of the culture and shapes their way of seeing things and thinking about things. In our culture, it is my feeling that one of the reasons why we've become so destructive is that we have such a profoundly unsatisfactory way of living. The figures are just always calamitous. Depression has gone up tremendously in the last 20 years. Suicide has gone up. Rage killings unknown when I was a young man. Things are getting worse and worse, and people are trying to make up for the shortfall with more and more gadgets, more and more sports shows and things like that. Whereas Lever peoples found that they had a very satisfactory life. They were what I would consider wealthy in the things that really matter to people. They didn't have a job to lose unless they made themselves an enemy of the tribe or something like that and were cast out. They lived in a society where if times were hard, everybody went hungry. There wasn't a certain class of people that ate and a certain class that starved as we have it. And when times were good, it was good for everybody. They had a very satisfactory life. If you read the anthropologists, they just don't report depression, drug use, insanity, crime, all that stuff that we're used to living with.
You often refer to Ishmael's subculture as starting in 92 and growing rapidly since then. And I'm wondering if you're establishing the publication of Ishmael as a date for a new beginning fails to acknowledge the similarities between Ishmael's focusing on the problems inherent in hierarchies, locking up food and saying that there's only one way to live, with the long tradition of anarchist writers, Bakunin and Kropotkin and Fabry, illustrate the connections of specifically these ideas about locking up food, saying that there's one way to live, and especially hierarchies. And I was wondering if you self-identify as part of that tradition, and if not, why not?
I don't see myself as part of that tradition because what I was examining was something that worked for humans for millions of years. In other words, the tribe. We evolved in tribes the way that bees evolved in hives. Species don't evolve as individuals. They have some sort of social organization. The tribe is a social organization. I was interested in discovering why that had worked so well for so long. And to call the people in a tribe as living in an anarchy is just nonsense.
In some ways, the word anarchy, is, as it's defined in the dictionary, doesn't pay enough tribute to the history of anarchist writers that were very eloquent about expressing some ideas that I see similar to your work. Readers often ask you, what can I do? How do you feel about constantly finding yourself in this position of being a person who's being asked to point people towards solutions for themselves and for the planet?
Yeah, I was surprised when Ishmael first came out that so many people had that question. It had seemed to me, I thought I'd made it clear in Ishmael, that what was at the root of our problem here was the way that we see the world as a human property that we can do anything with. At the time I was writing Ishmael, really nobody even thought that we could do harm to the planet. It was only that when Rachel Carson's book came out in 1962, Silent Spring, that people had any notion that we couldn't just limitlessly exploit the planet and do anything we pleased to with it. Rather than announcing a program for people, I was trying to show them that it was our mindset that was threatening the world. We see ourselves as belonging to a separate order of being from the rest of the living community, and this is a fatal error. We are definitely not separate from the rest of the living community. And what's critical to happen is for the people of our culture to come to their senses about this and to realize that there are limits. Till that happens, no program is going to accomplish anything. But as for programs for individuals, mostly what I tell people is that you know your own resources, you know your own sphere of influence, and I don't know either of those things. So I have no idea what you can do. But I don't give people a 12-step program, but that put the responsibility on them to find, think about what it is they can do.
I've seen Noam Chomsky in the position a lot, and he always says, if you're doing something about it, then you probably already know what you should be doing, and if you're not, then you're not doing anything. Because people always put him in that position as well. You said something about getting to the root of the problem here. In that sense, do you consider yourself a radical in the true sense of the word radical?
No, I don't. What I've done is to see things differently, to look at our culture from a great distance, like an anthropologist, which I expect is why my work is used so widely in courses in anthropology. You know, to look at it as if I were a Martian and say, you know, what are these people doing? And what is in their minds that they're destroying their own planet? What kind of people do that? What are they thinking? And that's what the subject of all of my books is.
I was just referring to the real meaning of radical as meaning getting to the root of the
issue. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
You do then draw some lines between yourselves and people who are calling for more rapid change or people who you consider to be radical in some way?
My point has been that nothing happens more quickly than changing people's minds. What happened in the Soviet Union was that from the 70s on, there was a lot of stuff at work there. And by the mid-80s, there was a sufficient body of people who had changed their minds that they were ready for what Gorbachev did. I give as an example the Renaissance. Several key ideas of the medieval mind came under challenge during the Renaissance. And because those ideas came under challenge, the principal one being the source of certain knowledge. To the medieval mind, the best sources of certain knowledge were reason and authority. So that if it seemed reasonable and there were, was an authority for it, then you could be sure of it, so that it looked to us as though the rest of the universe was revolving around us, so that made us the center of the universe. And Ptolemy assured us that it was so. In the Renaissance, this idea was replaced by the idea that certain knowledge is best attained by experiment and observation. And that, of course, was the beginning of the scientific revolution, the industrial revolution, indeed the modern world. We must have another Renaissance now, and the fastest way that can happen is by a new world vision spreading like a virus among people.
I see a lot of people reacting to your work in that they take it to extremes, claiming that you're against something or have called for an end to something. If somebody on your website, for example, writes, I know that you're against this, or I know you've called for an end to this, and you say, well, actually, I haven't.
Well, actually, I haven't, yeah.
Yeah.
If I say population tracks food availability for every species, if there's more food available, the population grows for every single species on the planet. If food availability declines, the population declines. And, of course, then I say, too, that it's very doubtful that we will be able to expand to, I forget what the latest estimate is, 12 billion, 10 billion in the next 50 years. The planet won't take it. That what is fueling this expansion is, of course, our increased food production. We are in a food race, a race between food and population, very like the arms race in which one side developed a new weapon and then the other side developed a new weapon, each trying to get an edge that was going to end the war. But of course it was impossible because each win on one side was met by a win on the other side. Same is true in food and population. Every win in food production creates a win in population, that is an increase. Someone will say, so, Mr. Quinn, you think food production should be cut? Of course, I didn't say that. I'm just describing, not prescribing. What's important is for people to realize that it is not, as Malthus thought, that food production tracks population. Malthus said, the more people there are, the more food we will grow. Now, if there are 10,000 people here in 1 year, and 10 years later, there are 20,000 people, it's because there's been more food. There has to be, because you can't make people out of nothing. I don't know what policies will be, but if in 200 years there are still people here, the policies will be different. They will have to be different.
How might Ishmael respond to hearing Bush say that now is the time and Iraq is the place in which the enemies of the civilized world are testing the will of the civilized world? The equation there of enemies of civilization with terrorism makes me wonder about, in the story of B, you pit B against the church. Does this Bush quote make you think maybe that ultimately it might be the state, not the church, which would mobilize against this enemy of the forces of being against civilization? Have you now or have you ever been a member of the Daniel Quinn Party?
I don't think that the people who manage the government have sufficient imagination to see me as a threat, whereas certainly fundamentalist Christians perceive me as the voice of the devil.
Have you gotten some nasty letters?
Very few, but something that teachers come across when they use one of my books in their classroom. But the state, I don't think there's an FBI file on Daniel Quinn.